January, it's Sunday, January 4th, 2009. It's a day that we're not at ease. And I want to begin, first of all, by saying the Vatora that I heard in the sukkah of my revered neighbor, Rabbi Yoshua Huttner, the brother-in-law of Rabbi Tzvi Yehuda Cook, during the Yom Kippur War in 73. So we were sitting in the sukkah, probably with Shabbat Chol HaMoed Sukkot. And this was obviously my first war in Israel. I had been here 4 years, and war is not an easy experience. And Rav Hutna said a Meirah Dikvot. He said, in Hallel we say, Yon HaShem Hoshiyana, and then a minute later, Yon HaShem Hatzlichana. He says, if God saved us, why do we have to turn to the Ribbono Shel Olam a minute later and ask him to make us successful? And Rav Hutna said, when it comes to the battlefield, he knows we're going to win. The Yehushter will save us. The problem is that the victory should be lasting, that we should politically be able to see that the victory is permanent. And that's the Yon HaShem Hatzlichana. Make us successful in our victory. So I mitpalel HaKadosh Baruch Hu that first of all, Yon HaShem Hoshiyana, with a minimum of karbonot. That's the worst part of war. And I'm a lamed zchut, you understand, everyone was critical of Barak, but I'm a lamed zchut, I would like to believe he was so hesitant to go to war, because when you've seen a battlefield, you understand already the price that one pays. So first, it should be on Hashem Hoshiyana, and then within the military victory, there we need tremendous siyata d'shmaya, that we should be matzliach, our politicians, to stand firm, to stand with dignity, and to see that our victory lasts. That's number one. Number two, on a personal level, ani rotzeh laodot l'Kadosh Baruch Hu, you all know that 2 weeks ago today I had an operation. And if you recall what a cataract was, I recall my grandparents, and it was major surgery, and people came out of it weeks later, and they needed heavy glasses, thick glasses, and I nimodel HaKadosh Baruch Hu that had the operation. I could tell you, I could pull your leg and say the surgeon happened to be my student. The anesthesiologist, it turned out, was the brother of a student I was very close to in the 60s. The nurses all had kisui rosh, not just because they were nurses, but because they were religious women. But that was only part of the story. The equipment was state of the art, and everyone was highly trained. So ani modeh HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he sent the right shlichim. And as you recall, a day after the operation, I already was back in Gruss the next afternoon, driving and functioning. Okay, now, I want to make, people are listening to my shiurim, and Rabbi Moskowitz of Chicago called me and made two corrections on things that I've said over the decades, and I'm very thankful when people correct me. So I want to just go on record. I quoted the Rav, I can't go into detail now, but those of you who know the Zoristic terminology on male and female, and I thought I was quoting what I heard Rebbe say. Maybe his tongue slipped, or maybe my ear slipped, or, but the correct term is dukra and nukva. Dukra. I don't want to say the way I said it incorrectly. That's the male, doker. Nukva is nekev, the whole, the female. I make that correction. The other correction is, I was speaking once about Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung in Montreal. And I evidently thought, and I if anyone knows any differently, you're welcome to comment. I evidently thought that Rabbi Avram Mordechai Hirschberg, who was rabbi in Mexico City, was his brother. I confused two different names. These are two different Talmidei Chachamim, both of Polish origins. They may have both studied in Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, and they're not brothers. They just functioned in the rabbinate, one in Canada and one in Mexico City, after being in Chicago at the same time. So I stand corrected. What's interesting is that there was a Rabbi Mordechai Hirschsprung who was in the first graduating class of the reorganized yeshiva that you are part of, known to the world as REITS, Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanah Theological Seminary. And in the first Chagas Smicha in 1919, Rabbi Mordechai Hirschsprung was the valedictorian. And it's interesting if Rabbi Mordechai Hirschsprung was at all related to Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung. So I put that on the put it out for anyone who can tell us. Yes, don't tell me you know this, Menachem.
Which Rosh Hashiva delivered the Dvar Torah at the Chagas Smicha that year?
That the Chagas Smicha was Rabbi Revel, was the main
Moshe
speaker.
Also?
Reb Moshe Soloveitchik was deep in Chaslovich when this took place. Trying to spoke at that was in the 30s.
What happened?
No, what you're talking about is 37. So your knowledge is a little bit faulty today. Not now. Now I have to move further. Ask me tomorrow when we have to deal with Kugel, with Professor Kugel. David, thank you for what you sent me. Okay, I want to begin. Number one. When we speak about Yeshiva University outlook, everyone has his own outlook. And Yeshiva University is very diversified, which is, in my opinion, to its credit. I just want to define what I mean by a YU outlook. And people call it modern orthodoxy, centrist orthodoxy. I personally object to all those titles for one very simple reason. Those of you who know me, I am not modern and I am not a centrist. And what I believe, there's no concept modern orthodoxy. What does that mean? Either you're a Torah Jew or you're not a Torah Jew. What does it mean a centrist? What I believe in as a fanatic. I'm proud to say Torah is a demanding, as the Rav used to say, Torah is a demanding mistress. You can't play games on Torah. So I'm not a centrist, I'm not modern. If you want to define what I believe in or how I define the Rav, it's Torah in Western context. That definition I can accept. In other words, as the Rav has taught us time and again, from time immemorial, we live in dual culture. We all face a certain amount of dialectical tension. The Rav's Torah, Avraham Avinu, I've said it a million times over, Avraham says to the people in Chevron, Ger v'tosha v'nochi imachem. On one hand, he's a ger. We're Jews. We're different. We think differently. We live differently. We're not Gentiles. I grew up in an Italian-Irish-Jewish neighborhood, the heart of the Bronx. And I know the Catholics inside out. I know the Protestants. We're different. We eat differently. We observe a different day of rest. Our sexual life is different. Our entire religious gestalt is different. So we live there. We're gerim. We're different. We wish each other well. Shabbat, we went to shul. They went to church on Sunday. They always wished us a happy Hanukkah or a happy Pesach. We wish them New Year's, the whole question, what can you wish? But all right, you wish someone to be prosperous and healthy. A wish like that is not a avodah zarah, and it's in good taste at all times. So on that level, we're different. We write differently. Just think, our alphabet, how we write. The difference, English, Hebrew, it's mind-boggling how different we are. On the other hand, we live in the United States of America. As I told a Jew who lives in the next building and davens at my, we daven marv in my building, Matzoy Shabbat, Matzoy Yontif, Matzoy Rosh Hashanah, we have a minyan in our parking lot. So we attract about 50 people. A block and a half away is another minyan in the parking lot. There they attract another 50 people and somehow the shuls are still filled. So I'm living in Israel 40 years. This man is living longer. He ran away from Germany in the late 30s. So he always tells me off because to the Americans who come to Davin, who I know from the day I entered YU, we speak English with each other. Lama temedabrim anglit mazatem lo shaltim bi'ivrit. He's always telling us off. So I told him, Tishma, you ran away from Germany. You don't want to speak German. We came on Aliyah. We ran away from nothing. And we're proud. Those are our roots. No one can put me down just because I used to root for the New York Yankees. Those are our roots. If they're Boston fans here or Dodger fans here, Aleihem Shalom, I apologize. So we live Gever Toshav. We're proud of American democracy. We're proud of American freedom of the press. We're proud, I know the New York police force, they make an effort to be friendly, right or wrong. They take people in the police force today, you can see Hasidic Jews in the police force. They try to get people, locals. The problem is you have to be a high school graduate. And not all Hasidim, one of the top people in the course, had to be drop out of the course because he didn't have a high school degree. Said he was going to get one. Fine. So, if you want to define what I believe in, at least what I think my Rebbe believed in, as a Torah Jew in Western context, I don't like the word Orthodox. Orthodox was coined by our detractors. It means Orthodox, one way, narrow-mindedness. It's Latin. I'm not narrow-minded. I don't believe there's one way to live as a Jew. Halachically, yes, we have to observe. Naseh v'nishma, shkafically, the world is open. We're sitting right here in this class, Ashkenazim and Sfardim. No, there are many differences between us. No one is going to say that Ashkenazim are not good Jews or Sfardim are not good Jews. And if you say it, you reveal your stupidity. Baruch Hashem, there's a lot of open-mindedness in the world in which I grew up. And I don't like the word Orthodox. I use the word Torah Jew in modern context, Torah Jew in Western context. Now, if we're going to contradistinct ourselves from the right-wing world, so-called, what are the differences? In my humble opinion, there are two major differences. Number one, there's a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Tet Zayin Amid Aleph. Kol Omer Devar Chachma Afilu B'Umat Olam Nikra Chacham. That a Gentile, a non-Jew, who has wisdom, we honor him. We call him a chacham. We call him a sage. In popular language, chokhma b'goyim tamin. If a non-Jew has wisdom, we honor him accordingly. We accept it. And there's a lot of wisdom among the non-Jews. How did I begin class? Thanking God for what a cataract operation is today. And I didn't realize how many people in my shul were watching me. Of course, I don't like to daven without a minyan. Whatever the reasons are, I don't want to tell you how many decades it is since I last missed a minyan, when a minyan was available. When I was working for the Mossad in Russia, not all the time did I have a minyan, but that's a different story. So my grandson called me 2 weeks ago Sunday, and he said, Saba, can I help you? I said, yeah, if you, instead of davening at the Shtiblach, come and walk me to my home shul, Olrifka, which is the closest shul. So I come to shul. Then it was a bad sight. Maybe I shouldn't have come, because, you know, people don't like to see someone all bandaged up. All right. The next afternoon, I'm back in shul. Normal guy. You know how many people came over to me from the shul? 4 or 5 people. They need cataract operations, and they're hesitant, they're diffident, and they saw, they asked me, what number, they told me, made an appointment with the specialist for this week. So who came up with these ideas? I'm pretty certain it wasn't only Jews. Jews probably played a role, but they're non-Jews. Who came up with the first heart transplant? Give me the name. Who's here from South Africa? No? Kristen Bernard. No, I say a good vat on him. When a Gadol b'Yisrael conquers the world and publishes Svarim and gives good Shayurim, what does he seek to do? To publish more, to be Mechadish more, to be Mechadish his life more. Dr. Bernhard conquered the world, changed the whole world. You know what he did after he came up with the first heart transplant? Divorced his wife, became a playboy, a lowlife, an eisfaf, a ladies man, a liquor drinker. The rest of his life, he was hobnobbing with celebrities. What a difference. But nevertheless, he may not have Torah, but he has Chokhmah. That much we have to acknowledge. Now, We have a positive outlook to Western culture where it can be positive. And here I'll tell you a story, and this story does not go free of charge. Pinchas, $36,000 to the IOU list in honor of the Rebbe, and you have a bargain. The wallet is out. Kol hakavod. Okay. What you fellas don't know, it was a terrible situation. When we came in Aliyah in Israel, we were really chalutzim. Today, you guys come in Aliyah, big deal, nefesh ben nefesh. You go into a supermarket, there's more frozen food available here than in the United States. We came, there was nothing, nothing, and nothing. Worse than that, there were no funeral chapels. Where was Shaarei Tzedek Hospital? Right beyond Machne Yehuda. The building today is the radio or TV building. I think it's the radio building. It's a landmark building. That was Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. Baruch Hashem, that there's a plaque that you know the Rebbe's not lying, not pulling your leg. How far is it from Machne Yehuda? A block and a half. Around the corner was the morgue of the hospital. They used to pull the bodies out in the stretcher, and you were muspid the bodies on the street with the hustle and bustle of Machne Yehuda and shopping and carrying and apples and oranges and bananas, and there Nebuch is the dead person. It was at a funeral. It's right around the Yom Kippur War. And it was a father of one of the Gush boys. Today that boy is a general in the IDF. And Rabbi Lichtenstein was being maspid. In the middle of the chesped, the Chevra Kadisha comes to Rabbi and pushes him down the block, stops everything. There's another funeral, another body has to be pulled. Disgrace is an understatement. Fine. A few weeks went by, and Rabbi held a press conference at the Gush. You all know what press conference means for a Rabbi Lichtenstein. Fine. So one of the questions from the audience, you know, and students are half honest and half chatzufim, wise Alex, which is the way a student has to be. It takes them a while to grow up. So a student shoots at Rabbi, what does he think of studying general studies, Western culture? And after Rabbi answers whatever he answers, the student says, but what about literature? And you understand, David, he's talking to Rabbi Lichtenstein, who has a PhD from Harvard in English literature. And it's a good question. Because after all, I spoke before about science. You can talk about math. You can talk about psychology. Fine, all this helps man. What the heck is literature? So Rabbi, this is classic, classic Rabbi at his best. Rabbi pauses and says, look, I'm not even going to answer your question. I'm just going to tell you a story. Were you at the funeral last week? Yes. What did you think when the Chevra Kadisha came along and pushed us away? A disgrace, horrible, terrible, lack of respect, backward, primitive. So Rabbi says, had he studied Hamlet by Shakespeare, he would not have acted that way. Remember Hamlet, death, his eulogy, elegy, call it what you wish, the termination of life, the tragedy. Believe me, that kid walked out and he was willing to establish a scholarship for the Chevra Kadisha in Yerushalayim to study Shakespeare. He had as much chance of accomplishing that as I have today of converting the wild African tribes to monotheism. I can't take questions today, Menachem. Relax.
Saying, yeah. The Tiferes Yisrael of his parish in Perkei Avos points out that there are several individuals, non-Jews, who are Hasidei
Umat Olam
and who have Chelek in Olam Haba, including Edward Jenner, who discovered a vaccine against smallpox.
Good.
Francis Drake, who perhaps...
Adarabha. Anyone who discovered a vaccine...
Johann Gutenberg, who created the
printing, press, Kolek Kavod. I'm going to quote it to Ferret Yisrael.
Johann Reuschlin, who...
We got the message. I'm going to quote it to Ferret Yisrael tomorrow in another context. Now,
okay.
Now, the... What I want to say before we go a step further, because I think there's a second aspect to being a modern Torah Jew in Western context, I don't agree with YCT, Yeshivat Chovevei Torah. Yeshivat Chovevei Torah has introduced two more principles. I met your brother. That's your Chavrita's brother. Got it, okay. It's all from England, that much I know. Right, not the same, Manchester and London, two different worlds. Come back here. Chovevei Torah has introduced two other aspects into this equation. And one of them is pluralism, and one of them is feminism. And Yeshivat Chovevei Torah makes two tremendous points: that YU is a school that is right wing, right of center, at points fanatical, and the big difference between us is pluralism and feminism. Now, all of you know I have devoted endless hours, hundreds of hours, to these two topics. But I want to say very briefly, these are problems for every Torah Jew. When it comes to pluralism, from Satma to Chovevei Torah, we all face the same dilemma. Are we willing to write off Jews? And on the other hand, how can we sit with a conservative and reform rabbi, because willy-nilly we are making a statement that you have freedom of choice? This is an Orthodox rabbi. Remember what I told you, what happened to me. This is a Chabad rabbi. It's a different religion, Chabad, in their eyes already. This is the reform and conservative agree with Rav Shach on Chabad. Very interesting. I don't agree with Rav Shach, but let the joke stand. So this is an Orthodox rabbi, this is a Chabad rabbi, this is conservative, this is reform. And well, you know what happened with a graduate of Chovevei Torah just a few weeks ago, where he formed a Beis Din for Geirut with two conservative rabbis, one a man and one a female, and fine. And that's the listen of Chovevei Torah lists on its faculty female rabbis, and it says they were ordained at Hebrew Union and JTS, and they lied to me. I don't like when people lie to me. You can say I'm wrong. You can differ with me. But when Aaron Rakefet files a complaint, and I'm told you're right, we made a mistake, we're taking it off the website, we're going to correct it, you can check the website. You all know how to use a computer, and you'll see that their promise to me was fulfilled, like Meir Tzidkun promised me to be Mesayim Shas with me and pay for the Kiddush at the Siyum Shas. As he fulfilled his promise, they fulfilled their promise. So pluralism is a problem. We struggle with it. I don't think it defines right-wing orthodoxy or centrist orthodoxy or Chovevei. We all struggle with it. The question is ultimately what we decide halacha l'maisa, and each one of us goes his way. There's no black and white answer. And all of you know that in this very institution, I'm the most fanatical of your entire rabbinic faculty. Or whatever the reasons are on this issue, I'm more to the right of my revered colleagues who teach Torah to the Kollel. The Seder. Feminism, I have to tell you, we're all caught up with the feminist challenge. It already began 120, 130 years ago, but it certainly picked up speed and intensified with the roaring 60s into the 70s for the Torah community. We all struggle with it. No one today is free of this question. And we have to deal with it. And I don't believe that the YU is insensitive to the problem. And I can tell you further, go to Lubavitch. They are light years ahead of us. They've already come up with a title. Here the women are yelling, make us rabbis. They call a shlucha a shlucha. He's a shaluch and she's a shlucha. Just think about it. They're working hand in hand. And you have to say it's sheer genius on their part. And the women at times, I'm told that when you see these rabbanim out all over the world, at times the women are more colorful and more effective and more inspirational than their husbands. So we're all struggling with it. And if you look at the curriculums of Satmar high schools in America for girls, you're going to find that the curriculum broadened over the years. So I don't feel that just to say we're concerned with feminist issues makes Chovevei Torah more modern or more Western than all the rest of Torah Jews living out there and interacting with the dialectical tensions of the big Western world. And I want to put in a personal note. What irks me and disappoints me when you hear people call the rabbis insensitive, this, in my opinion, is a blood libel. Some of you know that I don't repeat my lectures. My classes are ongoing. I wish I could go back in time. I spent endless years on the topic of the classic aguna, women who do not know where their husbands are. Not the not the man-made aguna, the aguna of today, where a woman can't get a deget because the man wants money, or at times, I have a case now just the opposite, where the man can't give a get because the woman wants money. For that get, she wants $30 million from this man. And this is a case going on right now. He does not have the $30 million. Believe me. So this is man-made. It's self-inflicted. But the classic aguna, God have mercy, after the Yom Kippur War, at first there were something like 500-600 women who didn't know what happened to their husbands. The great Rabbanim Amaisa Nefesh. They come up with endless learning. Millions of pages have been written on this topic, Lahatir Agunah. And you're sitting in a yeshiva called Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Have you ever read Rakofet, studied, not read, Rakofet Aron, where the author has a monograph on Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Specter and why he was called the Avi Agunat, the father of the Agunat? The man didn't go to sleep. He was an old man already. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan didn't go to sleep when he had a Shaila of an Aguna. He worked and worked and worked, and I believe I have the exact figures in my book, but I believe out of 163 difficult questions, 161, he was able to be Mati the Aguna where there was nobody. So I don't accept that. Chovevei Torah, fine, the pluralism, maybe more pluralistic. These are debatable issues. Feminism, you understand there's a divine system here. A man takes a wife. In order to end the marriage, the man has to give the get. Harayat mukudeshet li. And what are the keywords in the get? Harayat muteret l'chol adam. Those are the keywords in a get. And this is the reality. And you have to know where the husband is. The rabbis can't give a get. It's the husband who has to give the get. Free will. It's not a simple problem. These are divine laws if you accept the divine system. But God have mercy on us today. Money, 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 Madoff. I don't have to tell you that why you lose $14 million, $114 million. I have to say, I never knew that the treasurers in YU know how to be mefalpel in a Rashi and Taisvus with a Rambam like the Tel's Yeshiva. Reb Chaim Brisker would be hysterical. What kind of baloney is this? You thought you had $114 million. You announced to the world $114 million. You was part of your endowment fund when you counted it into $6 billion. Suddenly the money was only profit. What kind of double talk is this? What are we, nitwits? And then after YU began, Hadassah too. Yeah, I understand why, because the Balabatan will give money. They're saying, where did you invest the money? What, are you crazy? You let people play with the money and lose it? So suddenly, no, these were profits on paper, but they don't exist, just as they don't exist. They were never profits. We find a shalom. This does not go over with a Litvish mind. Maybe with a chassidish mind, if a rebbe retazeh, you know, with the rebellion, it can go over. You know what a rebbe is? Two chassidim were sitting and talking, saying, my Rebbe is so fabulous. It was raining here and raining here. And where Abu the Rebbe Gigate, where the Rebbe went for the Syrian boys, I have to talk English. There was no rain. And the other guy, your Rebbe is nothing. My Rebbe here was Shabbos, where my Rebbe walked, it was still Vakat, it was still the weekday. Understand? That answer is good for a Chassidic mind. It's not good for a Litvish mind. The Rav, if you gave that answer in class, the Rav would have bounced you out head first. Okay. Yes, Menachem.
Rabbi Arkadin writes that there are 150 cases.
150, thank you. He got it. Okay, and how many did he solve? Look into Rakafet Aaron, which Rakafet Aaron is on the website. No,
it's on the computer. It's not on the website.
It's on the.
I mean, a copy of the article for mechanical reproduction.
Okay. let me stay in my world. Don't confuse me, please. If I want the facts, I'll give them to you. So you say 158 cases. I think he solved 156, 155. Okay, so it's fine. It makes the point. My dear students, there's a second factor in a modern outlook or a YU outlook. And I think that has to deal with a totally positive attitude towards the greatest miracle to happen to the Jewish people since Churban HaBayit, and that is the state of Israel. Now you just think for one moment. You are sitting here studying, listening to a lecture, without a care in the world. As we sit here, tens and tens of thousands of soldiers wearing the uniform of the IDF, Tzahal, Tzva Hagana Israel, Israeli Defense Forces, their lives are on the line in battle. How many years after the Holocaust are we? 62, 65. Just think for one moment where we're at. And the whole world already is starting to yell, reach a truce. Signs within Hamas, reach a truce. Egypt, who would slaughter every Hamasnik if they could, reach a truce. What an army. What defense? You know what an army is about? That Jews can forge an army? Since when do Jews take orders from other people? How many of you belong to a shul? Jesse Katz just went back. I got regards. He davened in Young Israel, a century city. I want to know in the Young Israel, a century city, when the president walks in, do they stand up for him? Better yet, do they stand up when the rabbi walks in? I want to know, Shabbos morning during davening, how many critics there are walking around the president, the treasurer, the secretary, this is that good, and that is not good, and the secretary, and there's not enough for defense, and the rabbi's sermon is no good. Jews to take orders. The Kiddush Club, Ribbono Shel Olam, how many shuls splintered away from your Young Israel? A Black Hat Minyan, a Kiddush Club Minyan, a Happy Minyan, a Kalbach Minyan. Ribbono Shel Olam, you know what it means to have an army and Jews take orders and their units and their divisions, and you know what it means to prepare an army. You have any idea what's involved? I once finished the lecture at the Central Air Force Base of the country in my 15 years in the army. So I finished the lecture and the audience was enthralled and they want to honor me. They take me on a tour of the base. I was shaking. I couldn't believe my eyes. A four-story building. Go in. The building is just devoted to technical material on, I believe then it was the Skyhawk. I think it's before the F-15. I couldn't believe my eyes. And they showed me every accident that ever happened to any Skyhawk in any army. Right there, it's on file, the technical material. And people, that's a whole building. We're not talking now pilots and navigators. We're not talking about ground crews. We're talking about engineers that have to keep the planes flying. I couldn't believe what I saw. Building after building, just devoted. This type of helicopter, this type of plane. take the army? Where did we come from? When did we have an army before? I gave lectures. Chayalei Beit David. All right, we have hints of it in the Gemara, but from Chayalei Beit David until Tzva Hagana LeYisrael, where did we minister this? Rabbeinu Shel Olam. I can let out a secret. You know, one of my sons-in-laws was a high-ranking officer. What he does today, if he would tell me, he'd have to shoot me. But that's a different story. So one time, Danny came home from the army many years ago. It's the middle of the night, pitch dark. He takes me out. It was a young man. I used to stay up late. That I'm asleep early, then 12 midnight. Takes me out of my terrace. He says, "Abba, look through this. It gives me a mechanism. Take a look. It's broad daylight." He's a graduate in electro-optics from Machon Lev. He later gets the highest prize in peacetime from the army for development of electro-optics on Merkava 2, and then again he gets the same prize for developments on Merkava 3. Today already there's Merkava 4, which his son commanded. My dad grandson is a tank commander. So, what a miracle. You are not proud of the state of Israel? Leave out all the Zionism, leave out Herzl, leave it to my lectures, maybe we'll reach it next year, maybe the year after. I'm making a deal with the Kaddish Baruch Hu, keep me going in my Monday class for another 30, 40 years. I have so much to give over. We'll get there on a technical level. But Jews, after the Holocaust, how did the Rav put it? You know, the whole question of the Israeli flag, of the Hatikva. There are a lot of people who don't sing Hatikva, including people who should have more seichel. They don't sing Hatikva. All right, who wrote Hatikva? Imber wrote Hatikva. He wasn't a tzaddik. First of all, you're wrong. Naftali here, Simba, I'm the only one alive today who yet knew and can talk about his niece, who was the secretary of my sisterhood in Maplewood, South Orange, New Jersey. This was his niece. She used to entertain me with stories about her uncle. He was a Shomer Shabbos. He was crazy. That's correct. He was a Mekubal. He was a Kabbalist. He was a Shomer Shabbos. He wrote Hatikva. The Rav spoke about Hatikva and the Israeli flag. Do you remember the Rav's famous words? Rav Heschel Schachter's written it up. The halacha is, God forbid, when a person is killed in battle in a car crash, his blood is, his clothes are soaked with blood, you don't do a tahara. You don't undress him. You don't do a tahara. You don't put on a kittel. You bury him without tachrichim. You bury him in the clothes, because the blood has sanctified the clothes. The Israeli flag, the Jewish flag, how much blood was shed, how much hope was extended in the concentration camps that one day the Israeli flag will fly, how much blood has subsequently been shed for that flag. It is stained, it is soaked with the blood of wonderful Jews. Those of you who are in my Sunday class know they are Kedoshim, the Chatam Sofer, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, my conversation with the Rav. We should have a problem singing Hatikva? We should have a problem enabling children in day schools to feel proud that there's a state of Israel? The miracles of Israel, how much Torah is studied here, how many yeshivot are here, what BMT began 40 years ago. Think what has developed. Hundreds of thousands of youth have come to study, have been sparked, the whole Baal Tshuva movement. And don't forget, with all the difficulties we've had, we have more Jews living in Israel today than all of America and Canada put together. And if you want to measure by halachic Jews, you have more Jews living in Israel today who are halachically Jewish than the entire rest of the world, including Russia and France and Canada and South Africa and Australia. Put it all together and you don't equal the over 6 million halachically correct Jews, children of Jewish mothers, or who have converted kedat v'kedin, that adorn the Holy Land of Israel. And I'll tell you a little joke I pulled. A good vart. You won't forget it. Some of you know I have friends in all parts of the Torah world. So among my friends is a nephew of Rav Shalom Elyashiv, the great Rav Elyashiv, who's hitting 100. His nephew is well over his 80s, is married to Rav Elyashiv's niece. And we happen to be united in certain causes that we've worked together since 1981. So last year I went to see my good friend. He bears a very auspicious name in YU circles today. His name is Harav Kugel. And he may be a relative of Professor Kugel, I don't know. And it was before Yom Ha'atzmaut, and we were wishing each other well. And I said to him, Reb Lazem, you have to say Hallel on Yom Ha'atzmaut. I'm not allowed. He looks at me and says, I don't understand you. You're a Zionist. You're a B'nai Akivinik. I'm an Agudis. What do you mean? I said, no, I'm not allowed to say Hallel, and you are obligated. I'll explain to you. I said, I'm a B'nai Akiva kid. I grew up, I had a dream. I write about it in my new book. You read my chapter in B'nai Akiva and what it did for me and how it changed my life and the people I knew in B'nai Akiva. It's a fascinating chapter. A little bit, a drop of it is going to come out in Jewish Action in the spring issue when the world puts me into Chayrim for doing a major article on Rabbi Meir Kahana. So you'll see in that article on Meir Kahana, you'll understand already where I'm coming from. So I grew up in B'nai Akiva, we had a dream, we had a vision. I said, cook on, was is gevaren, take a look what became of our dream. Ach, a government. Who shames Shabbos? Who runs the country? Who runs the army? Look at some of the press here. If you read Haaretz, you have to read it. You can't wear clothes when you read Haaretz because you have to rip Kriya. Every third minute, you're chayiv to rip Kriya. The only way you can read Haaretz is to go into a sealed room in your birthday suit. And I didn't yet hear of a naked person ripping Kriya. Faket, he's not allowed to let it go to do it. And he's a dear writer. So I said, how can I say Hallel? How can I say Hallel? Look what became of the dream. But you, I said, the Rosh Yeshiva never was at Tzioni, never had a dream, never had a vision. Take a look at the country, the Siblitzach, how it's blossoming, how it's growing. Look at the amount of Jews, look at the technology, look at the inventions. Look at the shekel that's knocking the hell out of the dollar. How do you explain this? Look at the army. I said, this is Maasei Hashem. Minzet, we see that the world has a leader, that there's a God watching over his people. You have to say Hallel. I'm not allowed. He told me, I met him, he told Rabbi Yashiv, he said they were laughing so. He says, I'm still laughing. He says, all right. So I say, there are two tremendous qualities that characterize what I call a YU outlook. You can call it whatever you wish. Number one, an openness to the Western world on a high level. I'm not one to denigrate study. It can enhance us. It can enable us. We can live a life of dignity. And if a student ever came to me and said, Rebbe, I'm interested in Chinese literature. I'd like to major in it. The last thing in the world I would tell him is, what are you wasting your time? Go and learn Gemara and thump your way through college and get smicha and be a Rebbe in a day school, in a high school. The last thing I would tell him is be the worst Rebbe in the world. Frustrated, thwarted. To be a Rebbe, you have to feel the calling. There's nothing more important in life than being a Rebbe. Without our Rebbeim, there's no tomorrow. But would you go to a doctor who doesn't love his profession? Who's not excited about his profession? Who's not enthused with his ability to save life and grant vision? A Rebbe, you have to have that knack. You like Chinese literature? Become the biggest professor in the world. How many professors are there of Chinese literature? And you know something? If you do that, you'll have more time to learn Torah than five Rebbeim put together. You'll give two lectures a week. You'll publish a book. You'll be a full professor if you're a Ben Torah. All morning, you can sit and learn, and the university will pay your salary. So there's a lot to be said for being open to Chochmat HaGoyim on a high level. We're not talking about trash or pornography. And even when it comes to literature, you will know that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein has a doctorate. You will know that the Rav had tremendous feeling for literature. I once gave a lecture what the Rav did with Peretz and other Yiddishists and other writers and Banshit Zweig. And anyone who's read the Rav's philosophic writings sees the impact that literature has had upon him. And that, of course, comes from his mother, who introduced him to the world of Russian and Haskalah literature, and there is so much in there on a high, ennobling, human level. Secondly, what characterizes, in my opinion, a YU outlook is a good feeling towards the state of Israel. We don't have to be formal Zionist, and I don't want to go into a definition of Zion now, but what we have achieved, what has been accomplished, what the Ribbono Shel Olam has blessed us, where we have come from survivors of the Holocaust who got off the boats and immediately went into the Israeli army. How many graves there are on Har Herzl of people who we have no identity, no idea who they are. Tape, first two, working. People who we have no identity, who they are, we can't even do DNA because they have no relatives. Everyone was wiped out during the Holocaust. And then you talk about the Sephardic Jews who came, they don't come as Rach. They came impoverished. They ran away. They left everything behind. How many billions of dollars have been left in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, in Morocco, in Tunisia, in Algiers, in Libya, etc. And they came from a primitive society to a Western society, what they had to go through. And take a look today, and particularly in our circles, all barriers have broken down. How many inter-ethnic marriages I have attended where, Baruch Hashem, the kibbutz Goliath, who would ever dream that a Litvak like myself can daven Eidot HaMizrach? I'm not just talking Sephardic davening. I daven Eidot, you know, in the Shtiblach, in every second shul in Israel, you never know what the Nusach is until the Chazan opens his mouth. In the army, Rav Gorin tried to introduce Nusach Achid. So when I went in, you know, when I went into basic training and I saw what goes on, I said, yeah, he introduced Nusach Achid. It means in every shul in the army, you never know what the Nusach is till the Chazan opens his mouth. And you read my book where I describe in basic training, we made a Shabbat where the Nusach and the Divrei Torah changed at every opportunity. The Kabbalah Shabbat was one way, the Baruch Hu was another way. We had Chazanim and Rabbanim from every Eidah. I spoke at the meal. I got into a lot of trouble because I spoke about the, it was right before, it was right after Purim, I spoke about the Gemara in Megillah, Chayav Adam Lepsumi Bepur Yada Lo Yada, Yain Baruch Mordechai La'ara Haman. A person has to get so drunk he doesn't know the difference between Mordechai and Haman. And I said, my dear soldiers, colleagues, this applies to our commanders. We at times are not really soldiers. We are the commanders, and they are our soldiers. And everyone was hysterical with laughter. I was one step out of jail, but Baruch Hashem. Now what happened? Let me come in to the high point of today's lecture, because tomorrow I'm going to deal with halacha lemaaser, real cases, real differences. But what happened? Why do we have to talk about this? What has happened? Why is black beautiful? Why is this swing to the right? Why does Chovevei Torah have a field day portraying why you as a bastion of Mordei Ha'ar, we say in modern Hebrew, of people who are against the light of enlightenment, the light of Haskalah, the light of Zionism. What has happened? Where, what, when? How did America change so brutally and so clearly and so distinctly that a student of who I love sitting in this very room at this moment told me proudly last week, although he goes to IU, he doesn't believe in its ideology. What has happened? Well, I can tell you about a grandson of the Rav, shall remain nameless, who was at Harvard. And he didn't go to class. Before an exam, he studied, got a 70, a 71. This is a grandson of the Rav. The brains in this gentleman would send the brain measurer over the high point. It would break the chart. Like you hit the bell, get the gong, it would break the red thing on top. A 71, a 72. So finally a roommate said to him, I heard this story in Boston, in the Shtibble, where I used to, when I go to my daughter once a week, I daven in Boston. I love Boston. It's an amazing place. You see full professors with long beards and payas, full professors of the biggest universities, their kids don't graduate elementary school. It's unbelievable. So I eavesdropped. I told you, I've sinned. I've eavesdropped many times. You heard that in the Monday class. So I eavesdropped. Two guys are standing on the corner. I'm coming out of Maariv. They walked ahead of me, and I hear the name. The minute I hear the name, I say, ah, this is for me. So I have an extension of my ear. Suddenly I hear like a two-year-old kid, like a dog hears, you know, everything. My ear juts out, and I pick up the whole conversation. So I said, I don't want to mention the name, but I think you know what I'm talking about. I said to my roommate, why don't you go to Lakewood? What are you wasting your time in Harvard if all you do is sit and learn? And he answers, I wish I could go to Lakewood. I'm only in Harvard because of COVID for my grandfather. I wish I can go to Lakewood. What happened? What happened? Okay. Gentlemen, we go back in time to the 1900s, the 1910s, the 1920s, the 1930s. All of American Judaism that was observant of Torah was a very enlightened, open, forward-looking Judaism. You all know that the first person in America, despite the fact that Art Scroll does not acknowledge his existence, which is a terrible sin for Art Scroll, a terrible sin. It's because this man has no one left in the world today, not one descendant. His two sons didn't marry. There are reasons why. He gave his entire life to build Torah. And if you don't like YU today, disagree with YU today. No one disagreed with Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel when he began on the Torah scene as the founding Rosh Yeshiva and principal and later president, 1915, January 1916, the high school which I graduated opens its doors, Talmudical Academy. 1928, Yeshiva College opens its doors. I don't have to tell you what a yeshiva on the American scene. Students are going to high school, going to college, learning Torah, getting smicha. It is revolutionary. 1929, a young man comes to the United States, a greenhorn, 17 years of age, 18 years of age, can barely speak a broken English. I've seen letters that he wrote, the letters a three-year-old kid in Israel can write better English. Then Dr. Belkin comes to the yeshiva. Rav Shmuel Belkin doesn't have a doctorate yet, does have smicha at the age of 17, and Rabbi Revel, I would say, adopts him almost like a son. He goes on to Harvard, he goes on to Brown University, gets a doctorate, comes back to the yeshiva as the most beloved Rosh Yeshiva in the history of the yeshiva. There was no Rebbe that the Talmidim loved more. I yet knew the Talmidim of Rabbi Belkin from about 36, 37 till the day he had to stop teaching. And he taught in the graduate school and Greek and Latin in the college. And this YU, Toru, Mada, call it what you wish. 1932, another greenhorn comes to America. But he already knew a little English. He already knew German. He already had a PhD when he came to America. His wife had a PhD. And of course, I'm talking about Mori Rebbe. I shiver and shake when I mention his name. Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik Zitzal. And these three people, if you take Rabbi Rebel and you take Rabbi Belkin and you take Mori Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, or I should say Rabbi Soloveitchik, as I said Rabbi and the others, let me not differentiate. When you take these great Rabbanim, they were open. These people attempted not to transplant Torah in the Western world, but to translate Torah to the Western world. Underlying those two verbs, the difference between translating and transplanting. And all the other yeshivot, which barely existed, Teira V'Das, Chaim Berlin, RJJ, who began Teira V'Das? Mizrahi people, who began RJJ? Who began Chaim Berlin? These were all Jews on the American scene. These were all Mizrahi people. And all of America was heading towards this so-called YU shtans, this open, welcome embrace of Western culture. Who was Rav Ruderman in the 1930s? Nei Yisrael, college graduate. What was he? What do they call it? Handball champion. He won all types of events and in sports. Rebbeinu Shalom, what a world. Kepasa. No, que pasa? You walk the streets of New York, you know Spanish or you don't know Spanish. Without Spanish, you're dead. Your insurance, they won't sell you. What happened? What happened? What happened is very simple, and it's diagrammed very beautifully in George Kranzler. You know him as Gershon Kranzler, principal of the Beit Yaakov in Baltimore for many decades. Zichrono Livracha, knew him very well. Oh, what an individual, a Torah V'Das graduate, a PhD from the New School of Social Research, Columbia University. His doctorate on Williamsburg is classic. Doctorate appeared the first edition in 61, if I'm correct. You can check my bibliographies and some of my published books. And George Kranzler...
He wasn't principal of
Beit Yaakov. What was he?
He was not principal.
Well, he taught at the Beis Yaakov. But they tell me he was also with the Beis Yaakov. No, he wasn't with the Beis Yaakov. Thank you for the correction. I correct myself. Talmudical Academy being the one they call Chafetz Chaim. The one they call Chafetz Chaim. Okay, I don't know why I have I have to look again at his introduction. But I know he lived in Baltimore. That was his home. That's where he functioned. And that's where he raised his family. I taught part of his family. Stockdale is a brilliant piece of work, Williamsburg. And you find the answer in that volume. My family is in America 110 years. My wife's family is in America 140 years. Anyone who came at that time knew full well they were running the chance of losing their children to the American dream. You were risking your Judaism by coming to America. All of you are familiar with the Chafetz Chaim's classic word, Nidchei Yisrael, which was written for the Jews in America. How does the Chafetz Chaim end his volume? No. The guy I know named Rakefet translated into English. The whole last paragraph, it's in the Silva era. Remember his words? My dear Jewish brethren, you've made enough money. You've tasted America. You've put together some dollars. Please come home. Return to Poland. Return to White Russia. Return to Lithuania. Return to Galicia. Because that's the only way you will guarantee that your children will remain Jewish. And that's the way the Chafetz Chaim ended off his Nidchei Yisrael. Now, you just think for a minute, he was right. The assimilation in America, the chances of my wife being Jewish after a family is 140 years in America, I would say it's 1,000 to 1 against it happening. The chances of my being Jewish, all right, the turn of the century, so maybe it's 100 to 1. But you knew it meant you were willing to take the risk or you didn't care. With the end of the 1930s, for the first time, a Jew is coming to America, not because he wants to, not because he wants the gold or the silver, not because he wants the beauty of Western civilization, not because he's enthralled by the Statue of Liberty and Lazarus's beautiful poem. He's coming to America to save his life. He's running away from Hitler. He is not emigrating to the United States. And many of these Jews, not all, but many of these Jews had one ultimate value, Torah. And the Torah they knew was the Torah of their youth. And they wanted no part of a translation to the United States. What they wanted was to transplant everything they knew in the old home, known in Yiddish as the Alte Heim, and that expression, the Alte Heim, you'll find in the New York Times. It's entered into Webster's Unabridged. That's how famous that concept became, the Alte Heim. The best story is the sixth Lubavitcher Rebbe. This is a story recorded by eyewitnesses. It's a fabulous story. I actually knew people who were there at the boat. The Rebbe was running away, he was saved, they pulled him out of Poland. It's 1940. President Roosevelt, the State Department. And there it appeared in the Jewish papers. There were about 4 Jewish dailies at the time. One of them was religious, the rest were not. One was Zionist, one was socialist, one was communist, the Freiheit, at least in 3 of the 4 papers, an ad was published. Hadmur mi Lubavitch, those of you that hold Lubavitch near and dear, those of you who remember Lubavitch, the Rebbe is coming to America. He's on this boat. He's going to arrive at this gangplank. Please greet him. One of my wife's cousins was there. He may still be alive. He was married to my mother-in-law's first cousin, a son. We just asked. We have to check. Because he went into a senior citizens and we lost track. Has to be, you know, hitting 100. And he was there. And he told me, but I read about it afterwards. He said a crowd came out or about this. There's video coverage of this, which Lubavitch put out. There's movies, black and white movies that Lubavitch put out today, and a video may already be in a DVD. And there are about 5,000 people at opposite Battery Park. They're bringing the Rebbe. And most of the people weren't even religious. People in their youth, you know, they still knew what Lubavitch was. They had been raised in Lubavitch. They remember the chulin from Lubavitch. Just think what I just said. It's a very deep sentence, although it sounded very trite. They remember the chulin from Lubavitch. And the Rebbe comes off the gangplank. He's wheeled off. He was crippled already. He had a stroke. He couldn't speak. The present Rebbe later becomes his spokesman. His wife could speak. She spoke well in Yiddish, and Rose Lieberman, Zichrona Livracha, that's, if you know Rabbi Adam Mintz, it's his grandmother-in-law. Rose Lieberman translated for the Rebbetzin into English. She was American-born, and when the Rebbetzin spoke in Yiddish to the press, she translated. So as they wheeled the Rebbe in, someone strikes up a niggun from the Alte Heim. A Chassidic niggun from the Alte Rebbe. And everyone joins in, and eyewitnesses told me, and others, it's written up, people started to cry. People distant from Yiddishkeit, they started to cry. people swore they wouldn't be mechallel Shabbos again. They had a problem with their wives. That you don't understand, that you're raised in the generation of computers and TVs and videos and shmidios and whatnot. You have so much entertainment. You have TVs with eight different screens, got eight different games at one time. There's no end to what you can do. What you don't know is, in the 30s into the 40s, you went to a palace Saturday night. You know what a palace was? A palace theater. Everyone went to the movies. They were called the RKO Palace. You asked your grandparents, your great-grandparents in Brooklyn, in the Bronx. You can still see in Beverly Hills, in North Beverly Hills, in the Rodeo Drive. That used to be a palace, a movie theater. No, a lady should go to the palace with her husband. She schleps the husband. He slept during the movie, but that's a different story. She should go. Her hair, a woman has to be, understand. She had an appointment 10 o'clock Saturday morning at the beauty parlor since 1929. She's going to give that up? The men came home resolved never to work on Shabbos. The women said, don't bother me, I have to go to the beauty parlor. You know when the women became Shomrei Shabbos? When their kids went to yeshivat and the kids said, Mommy, we're embarrassed to go to the beauty parlor Shabbos. What a woman won't do for her husband, she will do for her children. That's the secret. And that's that the Rebbe came. Anyway, they took the Rebbe to the west side. I believe it was the Greystone Hotel. Again, you can correct me if I'm incorrect. The hotel no longer exists. It was on the upper west side. And that night, the few chassidim who were still from and had money came into the Rebbe. And they said to the Rebbe, again, I'll say it in English. It's hard for me to say it in English because I'm living it in Yiddish. And I heard the seventh Rebbe tell the story with my own ears when why you guys went to a Fabrengen many generations ago. And he knew who we were from YU. And the Rebbe told the story. Then I have it on a video where they recorded the Rebbe telling it again in the 70s. But it's written up. So they came into the Rebbe, they said, Rebbe, we have good news for you. They said, we have in Lakewood, it's a nice community, it's warmer than New York, there are a few chassidim there that are wealthy, they arrange for the Rebbe to live in Lakewood, and we will come out once a month to have a fabrengen with the Rebbe. And they said, and Rebbe, you don't have to worry, it's time you retired, you've suffered so much under the communists, under the Nazis, your health is not good, and America's a waste of time anyway. So the Rebbe told the seventh Rebbe, you can imagine, was war Kriyat Shema hab denach gesagt, what type of Kriyat Shema he said when Hasidim tell the Rebbe that he has to retire. The next morning, the Chassidim came in to have breakfast with the Rebbe, Labriyut. Everyone is excited. The Rebbe is here. And the Rebbe says to the Chassidim, Morai v'Rabotai, he says, where I come from, a Rebbe tells his Chassidim what to do. He doesn't allow Chassidim to tell the Rebbe what to do. And he says, I'm going to go out to Lakewood. Going to rest up a month. I may be off in small details, but the gist is absolutely correct. At the end of the month, we're starting all over, and we're going to prove that America can be exactly like the Alter Heim. The Hasidim listened to the Rebbe. They thought he was crazy. I didn't say that. But a Rebbe speaks. You don't say a word. The end of a month, he calls in the key Hasidim, including Rose Lieberman's father, Kunin. Those of you from the West Coast, this is Rabbi Kunin's grandfather. He calls in key Hasidim, and he says to them, I want to open a shtibble in the finest neighborhood in New York City. So the Chassidim say, he says to the Chassidim, how do you know what the finest neighborhood is? So the Chassidim answer, we'll go and see where the biggest conservative temple is. And that's how Lubavitch gets to Eastern Parkway, the Brooklyn Jewish Center, the biggest conservative temple in the world, which today is owned by Lubavitch, was right on Eastern Parkway. They went and bought a little brownstone, 770 Eastern Parkway, and that's the way the Rebbe began. That's Chassidus. When I was a kid, there was a tremendous pull for a Lithuanian mind. And I have to admit, I've always been attracted to Lithuania because of the Mir crowd, the Shanghai crowd. From the time I was in seventh grade, I was a Litvak. For good or for bad. I'm not here to convince anyone. Those of you that heard my shiurim over the years on Lithuania and Chassidus, so they know I've been exposed. Fine. We were kids in high school. We had one dream. To get to Lakewood. Rabbi Aaron Cutler, the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva. Again, I've written a great deal. Look into Rakafat Aaron, you'll find a great deal on Kletzk, on Slutz, how it began. Rabbi Aaron's father-in-law, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, the Slutzker Rav, the Ritbaz, I did postdoctorate research, it's all published. It's all there. Rabbi Aaron comes to America. Why Rabbi Aaron came, they had a visa. They had to decide which Rosh Yeshiva to send. And Rabbi Aaron was basically the least famous of the Rosh Yeshiva in Europe because he was a young, I think he was 49 at the time. And there were Rosh Yeshiva who were much more famous. But they said, Rabbi Aaron is young. What he can do, an older person cannot do. So they sent Rabbi Aaron to America in 1941. He arrives in San Francisco. Comes all the way on the train to New York City, the Kletzker Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Aaron Cutler. Gets involved with Hatzalah work, read all about it in the Silver Era, read all about it in those that came after me and wrote about Hatzalah. By 1943, there's no one you can save. Every last Jew is being killed, is being gassed, is being sacrificed on the altar. There was no one else you could save. Finished. So at that point, they asked Rabbi Aaron, look, there's no more that Bar Hatzalah can do. But there are a few young people here from Europe that need a Rebbe, a few Americans that want a Rebbe, that want Lithuania. And Rabbi Aaron, I'm compressing the details because it's much more involved than I'm telling you. But Rabbi Aaron goes to Lakewood, and Lakewood begins with a handful of students, mainly Alta Kletzka, who survived, who got to America, and a handful of Americans. I was a kid, Lakewood, Rabarn, the heart of Lithuania. I had to go to Lakewood. Go to Lakewood, you got to take a test. You got to meet Rabarn Cutler. I go out to Borough Park, and you don't know, for a kid from the Bronx to go to Borough Park, that's the other end of the world. It's not today you drive your cars, you go to the computer, you download the route. It's the other end of the world. I think three subways were involved. Get to Lakewood, Rabbi Aaron, three-story walk-up. And I expected to find angels, Rabbi Aaron Cutler. And he had one room, the way I live today. Today I live even in a smaller room, but it's Israel. Everything is in that room. You eat there, whatever, you learn there. And I walk in and I see targets, dot targets. And there are his little grandchildren crawling on the floor, throwing darts at the target. You follow? And that's my introduction to Rabbi Aaron Cutler's home. I didn't see angels, but I saw little kids playing, crawling on the floor, 3, 4 years old, darts at the target. Then I meet Rabbi Aaron Cutler, maybe all of 5 foot. 2, 5 foot 3. His eyes, there were no pupils. There were little Sifrei Torah right in his eyes. Gives me a faher, a bechina, in your language, a faher in my language. We were learning Kedushin in the yeshiva. And how can I say it to you? How do you translate that? My mind, I asked the question of the Masha. You don't learn Masha today. You're busy with Art Scroll, with Steinsaltz, whatever. Listen, the generations have moved on. I'm not being critical, believe me. After I saw my grandchildren look at Rav Steinsaltz, remember what I told you. That was worth $1 million to me. I'm not being critical. But we learned with the Mashon and the Maram to understand the Gemara, Rashi, Tosfat, and I asked the Mashia's question, and I gave the Mashia, I was a little 16, I gave the Mashia's answer. And I tell you, Rabbaran's eyes were like Sifrei Torah. It was just unbelievable how he rejoiced that an American youngster, a gangster, call an American kid what you wish, could ice cap a Mashia. And I was accepted into Lakewood, and it was a beautiful period in my life. There are reasons why afterwards I left. Read about it in the book. I'm just about completing the manuscript, but it's not for now. But Reb Aaron, he was not at all interested in America, in translating, in being part of the American scene. He had one dream: to transplant Kletsk, Slutsk, Lithuania on the virgin soil of the United States. And that was the tremendous difference between him and the Rav. And he and the Rav were very good terms, very friendly. They had tremendous derech eretz for each other, as different as their hashkafas were. But they were both litvishe talmidei chachamim who knew how to learn and knew how to deal with the Rambam and knew how to analyze the Rambam. And there was a tremendous relationship which later continues with Reb Shneur Kotler, who was extremely close to the Rav. I can tell you, I was a ben bayit by Reb Shneur Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and he told me that when he came back to America, it had to be about 49 from then. This I'm telling you, Eidut Nemana. My ears heard this directly. This is not Eid Mipiet, or this was not from Moscow. This is direct. I'm the eyewitness, ear witness. He told me when he came back and from Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, his father, in Eitz Chaim, his father sent him to attend the Rav Shayurim at YU. And I said, "No, how are you impressed?" So he told me the Rav Shurim were fabulous. He says the students weren't too, don't believe they're serious the way they dress, so informal, you know, lackadaisical. Oh, you should see why you today. When you walk in on Shabbos and then I see my students, I'm the lackadaisical, informal individual. The rest of them are, well, Rabbanan Kotler would have nachat. But that's what Rav Shneur told me. And I didn't respond, I was a kid. Today I would have said to Rebbe, you got to look beneath the outer veneer. These young men, some of them are filled with Yirat Shemayim and learnedness and commitment. They're going to change the world. You have to look beyond the outer veneer. But that was Reb Aaron Kotler. And no one succeeded more. If we are sitting here in this room today, it's because of Reb Aaron Kotler. And I will give a gift to anyone who will explain my words. Anybody, one challenge, thrown out. Yitz, the Rebbe said, he is sitting here. You are sitting here. This building is here. Reb Aaron Kotler. Nah, you don't understand. Gentlemen, when I graduated the yeshiva in 1961, I got smicha, I was all of 23 years old. All right, I admit, I knew how to learn. It was a different era then. We didn't have Steinsaltz, we didn't have Hartzkroll, we didn't have Schottenstein, as my grandchildren say. We didn't have Schottenstein. I met him, I know him. No, we didn't have any of that. We knew how to learn. A kollel? Get the heck out of here, into the rabbinate with you. Dr. Belkin kicked me out head first. A year later, Baruch Hashem, he brought me back to be a rabbi. They had an opening for a yeshiva. He had promised me I'd be the next appointee. But he appointed me on condition I have to remain in the rabbinate. Couldn't leave the rabbinate. Again, there are many details here, but this very briefly. Who heard of a kollel? If you do a PhD one day in the history of Yeshiva University in modern times, you will find Ani Rothkopf was the last Rosh Yeshiva appointed who did not learn in its kollel. By 92, 62, 63... Yeshiva began a kollel already. Today there's one and two and three and four. I can't even count how many kollelim they are. Thank God Madoff did not bankrupt the kollelim. Whose idea was kollel? Who brought kollel to America? Who put kollel on the map? Reb Aaron Kotler. Lakewood made the statement that no kid at 23 knows how to learn, but Medav Zitzin and Lenny have to sit and learn and continue. And this is Reb Aaron. And no one succeeded more. And it's not just Lakewood. Lakewood has how many sitting in the Kollel today? Thousands. It's not just Lakewood. Every yeshiva that values its reputation has a Kollel. And YU has a lot more than one Kollel. And Baruch Hashem, it even has a Kollel in the hills of Jerusalem on Givat HaRakafot, which is the critical name of this parcel of land between Givat Mordechai and Bayit Vagan. It has a Kollel that is famed throughout the world, known as Grus Kollel in Jerusalem. I say thank you to Rabbi Aaron Cutler for bringing or helping to bring this Kollel about. One more point today, but a point that I begin now and say very briefly, to do it properly, years of lectures, but I start you off like Hillel and the Ger. The rest you have to finish. By the way, the Rav says time and again, if the Ger would come to him and say, teach me the Torah al regel achad, he would beat the hell out of him like Shammai and kick him away. But that's the Rav. I don't know. Rabbi Reuben would not be that way, I can assure you. Right or wrong. You've heard the Rav say it? Ichalt v'shamay. Openly. I hear him saying it. Gentlemen, what other individual arrived in America? How many of you have studied the volume called Bernard Revel, Builder of American Jewish Orthodoxy? If you recall, in that volume, there's a description of Rabbi Revel's work against the clock to save people from Europe. One of the people he served was Rabbi Dr. Joseph Breuer, the grandson of Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. Rabbi Breuer comes to America. A number of German balabatim, including my grandchildren's great-grandfather on their father's side, met and organized a synagogue known as K.A.J. Kehilat Adat Jeshurun to give Rabbi Breuer a shul where he would be comfortable. Rabbi Breuer immediately went to Rabbi Revel to thank him for saving his life. Rabbi Revel invited him to teach in Yeshiva College. And Rabbi Breuer absolutely, totally, and completely said no. And here you have a tremendous question that until today they're still writing about you for the latest issue of, what's it called, that Shalabim puts out. Ma'ayan, I think it's called Ma'ayan, correct me if I'm wrong. The scholarly journal of originally Polei Agudat Yisrael, the latest issue, filled with articles, who was Rav Hirsch, what did Rav Hirsch believe in, what is Torah Derech Eretz, and everyone is involved, and everyone lectures, and everyone has a say, and everyone has a viewpoint. What is Rav Hirsch all about? Fine. It's a simple question. Rabbi Breuer should love YU. What was the slogan, the aphorism of the Hirschian movement? Yafet Talmud Torim Derech Eretz, in simple language, Torim Derech Eretz, in simple English, for the sake of these lectures, tides, Torah in Derech Eretz society. It washes your body, it cleanses the soul. Tides, Torah in Derech Eretz society. It's not original with me. In 61, I had a balabas who was a great proponent rabbi, Dr. Elmer Affenbacher, not rabbi, Professor Affenbacher, and he always used the term tides. What is why you believe in? Tum, Torah u'mada. Tides versus tum. Shouldn't they love each other? Shouldn't they be attracted to each other? Shouldn't they merge with each other? Shouldn't they hold each other's hands? Shouldn't they march together in dignity? Why did Rabbi Breuer turn down Rabbi Revel? Gentlemen, the answer to that question stares you in the eyes at Yeshiva University at this very moment in time. What's troubling you? What's going on at Yeshiva? Why is the world shaking? Why is the infighting reaching a crescendo like never before? Who spoke under the auspices of Yeshiva University this past week? Professor James Kugel. Do I have the right name? James Kugel. All right. Rabbi Breuer came into the yeshiva and asked Rabbi Rebel for a catalog. He looked at the catalog on an ancient Chinese Hatem Nishgut Gevarin. You know what that means? He was sick. Why? He took a look on the curriculum. They teach Bialik. They teach Acharaam. Students can study general culture that's not Torah, that's anti-Torah, that goes against Torah Shebaal Peh, at times Torah Shebichtav. Professor James Kugel, I don't know him. I read what he spoke about. It's absolutely parva, but they tell me he believes in Wellhausen and he's published books supporting Wellhausen. Fine. But why, you will say, we're a liberal arts college. They quote a professor from Bernard Revel. Again, I don't know these people. It's not my field of specialty. Students have to be exposed. They have to know what's going on in the world. Damashatashiv. Rabbi Breuer, Chas v'chalila. Torim derech eretz. It means Torah is the ultimate value. And all the derech eretz has to fit into the Torah mold. If I can put it a little differently, tides versus tum. Torah im derech eretz. What does im mean? Interconnected. It's not separate. It's part of the reign of Torah. And everything a human being does has to be dictated by Torah. And that was the Hirshian approach. And of course they studied secular knowledge. Of course they studied German culture. But when it differed with Torah, it was strictly forbidden. YU has a different point of view. Tum, Torah, umada, to and. It's not im, it's not integrated. It's two separate disciplines. And if you want Torah, it's real Torah. As the Rav used to say, read about it in the second volume of the Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. A Lithuanian yeshiva on the highest level. What did the Rav say? Even in Volozhin, they would have been proud of my students. And then at 3 o'clock, my students go upstairs and it's a real university. Like Harvard, like Yale, like the University of Berlin, where the Rav studied in the mid-20s. So you see, the YU outlook had no muzzle with what happened as World War II approached. The Lubavitcher Rebbe set the tone. Hasidus can be rebuilt in America. The Alter Heim, it is no different. And you all know the success that Hasidus had, Lubavitch, Satma, Bavov, Square, Bells, Gair, Vishnitz. Go to Borough Park and you'll be overwhelmed by how many little Batei Migdash you will see on every street corner. Bavov is so big that the square is called Bavov Square. You can't get lost when you go to Bavov. Not only that, Reb Aaron Cutler, Lithuanian Torah transplanted from Europe. Not 1 ounce inch of translating it. Vidi Alta Heim. It has to be like the old country, the way we learned in Kletsk, in Slutsk, in Mir, in Panovich, in Telge, in Brisk, in Radom. And then if that wasn't enough to score a knockout of YU thinking, along came Rabbi Yosef Breyer, the man, the grandson of Rav Hirsch, the son of Rav Shlomo Zalman Breuer, son-in-law to Rav Hirsch, the man who believed in tides, the great rabbi who knew Tanakh by heart and had tremendous bekiyut in Shas and had a doctorate. And he looked at YU with its tum and declared them tumtumim in the full sense of the word. Bialik? Haram, Darwin, literature, trash, Greek mythology, etc. So we've set the stage. That's the background. That's the story. So much more to tell, but you get the picture. My dear students, let me reiterate. Number one, Ani Modeh LaKadosh Baruch Hu. We began the shiur with words of thanks. And in the words of the Rav in Ish Halacha, we have to be thankful for medical progress. But aper yed aper, the dignity that medical progress has brought to human life. Number two, we said Divrei Torah on the war. And al yehei hadavar hazeh kal be'einenu, that we can sit here b'menuchat hanefesh and teach. And tens of thousands of young people, among them our students, among them our children, our grandchildren, our friends, are right out there in the mud, the dirt, their lives in danger at every second, fighting tremendous battles. Ana Hashem Hoshiana, but our prayer has to be Ana Hashem Hatzlichana, that this time the victory should be translated into a permanent political victory. Then we began the shiur and I tried to define for you what I call YU outlook. It's my personal outlook. It's the way I was raised. I think I reflect the Rav, but you be the judge of that. Or those who knew the Rav, let them be the judge of it. And I said to you there are two main dominant themes in my world that do not exist in the so-called right-wing world, black world, call it as you wish. Number one, we are open to Western culture. I don't want to declare a chacham of the general world as not being on that level. If Chazal could call him a chacham, we certainly have to bow our heads to the geniuses who have given us so much progress and so enhanced the dignity of human existence. And if a person is attracted to general knowledge, let him be the greatest professor in that field. He must always remember the height and start of everything is Yirat Shemayim. Reshet Chachma, Yirat Hashem. And I have to say, I taught that to my grandchildren at a very early age. They repeated to me as adults today, be a rocket scientist, but always remember Reshet Chachma, Yirat Hashem. To be a Rebbe is the most important calling of all, but you have to have that ability. If you don't have it, you'll be a miserable Rebbe, and a miserable Rebbe creates miserable students. The second aspect of what I call a YU outlook is simply a pro-Zionist attitude towards the reality of the state of Israel. I don't want to get involved here with the nitty-gritty. Are we Zionists? What is Zion? I'll deal with all that next year, the year afterwards. But Ribbono Shel Olam, the miracles of our existence stare us in the eye. And one has to be thankful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And all of you who vote Agudat Yisrael have to say Hallel twice over on Yom HaTzmaut. Guys like me, we have a problem. That's a different story. What happened? Kepasa. And that's what I spoke about. There's no question until the late 30s, Rabbis Revel, Belkin, Soloveitchik ruled the world. And even other names even other names like Rabbis Ruderman, Feinstein, Kamenetsky, who had not yet arrived, he arrives in 41, but everyone, to a certain degree, followed in the mold of the first three rabbis I mentioned. But big changes happened. George Kranzler's volume is fabulous because it's based upon interviews and you hear the people speak, and one after another they say, I came to America, but I want my children to be raised just the way I was raised in Poland. And when I see my kid with payas and a chassidische younger man in Williamsburg, I know I have succeeded in America. And that was a theme that the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Baron Cutler, and even Rabbi Yosef Breuer shared in common. And I ended off by showing you the difference between tides and tum. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, I want to deal with contemporary problems and where I find a chasm between my Torah gestalt and some of the thoughts that are expressed in the so-called right-wing world. My dear students and guests, and I didn't say hello to all those listening all over the world, so I say hello at the end of the year. Until we meet again in health and happiness tomorrow at 9:05, and with best regards to Jesse Katz, who is back in the big world, Das Vedanya. Thank you very much. Okay, so did you reach my daughter?